13. Assunpink Creek, outside Trenton, New Jersey, January 2, 1777, 3 p.m. For George Washington, there is no rest. Just 7 days after his stunning victory at Trenton, the general once again looks out over that besieged city. Rain falls on the colonial positions as nearly 6,000 rebel soldiers prepare themselves for another battle. Washington has led his men across the frozen Delaware yet again, seeking to hold on to the momentum gained in last week's stunning victory. Morale is high among the colonial troops, despite rampant dysentery and a shortage of shoes. Footnote: other than their amazing victory at Trenton, one other key reason for high morale was a $10 bonus for reenlistment, which Washington paid in cash to each man on New Year's Day. Most soldiers made just $6 a month, so this was a large amount of money. This moment marked a change in the Constitution of the Continental Army that had been under discussion by Congress for months. Americans were once opposed to the idea of a standing army, preferring small militias of citizen soldiers and short enlistments. That changed late in 1776. The Congress began to see that only a trained fighting force would defeat the British. The standard enlistment was changed from a few months to either 3 years or the length of the war. Early in 1777, Congress also approved Washington's request for greater numbers of artillery, infantry, and even cavalry, which had been in short supply on the American side until then. "A regular army and the most masterly discipline," insisted John Adams, who had once opposed such a force. "Without these, we cannot reasonably hope to be a powerful, prosperous, or a free people." End footnote. Sensing victory, many men have reenlisted, and a new complement of untrained militia has joined Washington's veteran corps. His army has once again made the treacherous journey across the frozen river. The general believes that controlling Trenton and the nearby city of Princeton might make it possible to push the British completely out of New Jersey. However, Trenton is indefensible. Washington has seen this for himself, so rather than take up positions in the heart of town and suffer the same fate as Colonel Rawl and his Hessian garrison, Washington is setting a trap for the British, who he believes will counterattack shortly. The general's army holds the high ground overlooking Trenton. The steep banks of the Assunpink Creek lie before them, the ice-choked Delaware flows to the left, and a thick swamp adds protection to the right. Washington's cannon are sighted on King and Queen Streets and on the vital bridge spanning the creek. Washington's infantrymen have dug in behind protective earthworks, their bodies shielded from musket fire and grape. There is no attempt to hide their presence. Tents have been positioned, and campfire smoke curls into the sky. This is the battle George Washington wants, in the location he has chosen. Spies have alerted His Excellency to the advance of English Commander Charles Cornwallis. The Lieutenant General's winter leave was abruptly cancelled due to the recent colonial victories. Instead of sailing home to see his wife, Cornwallis celebrated his 38th birthday on New Year's Eve, then the next morning galloped 50 miles from New York to Princeton. There, he immediately assumed command of the 8,000-man British and Hessian garrison. Cornwallis believes that speed is vital to combat, so he does not delay in marching on Trenton. This morning, after leaving a small force behind to hold Princeton, his army began a 10-mile trip. The trek has been neither quick nor easy. Thick mud has slowed the 28 cannon and the supply wagons. American snipers, shooting from the cover of snowy woods, have further hindered the British advance. But now, as the winter sky grows dark, Cornwallis finally reaches the outskirts of Trenton. His men and horses are filthy, the red clay of the muddy road from Princeton coating man and beast alike. George Washington hears the unmistakable sound of an approaching army, whinnying horses, creaking caisson wheels, the bawl of commands. Soon after, he sees the first columns of redcoats. It is a much larger force than he anticipated. he quickly realizes that not only is the Continental Army outnumbered, but the British and Hessian lines are comprised entirely of professional soldiers, while Washington's army is overwhelmingly inexperienced. Many of his soldiers were making their livings as shopkeepers and farmers just a week ago. Washington knows he is in trouble. Such a large army can easily surround his men and slowly tighten the noose. The rebel position, which just moments ago seemed ideal, now feels tenuous. Quickly, George Washington strategizes a new, bold plan. Moments later, the first wave of British troops opens fire. The differences between George Washington and Charles Cornwallis could not be greater. Washington was raised as a middle-class Virginia planter. His fortune was earned through marriage, ambition, and a knack for achieving great success through hard work. Indeed, from farming to diplomacy to leading men into combat, Washington excels at all. That's why the Second Continental Congress named him Commander-in-Chief, and even after the horrific setbacks in New York just a few months ago, his men continued to fight hard for him. Washington is meticulous in his paperwork and correspondence, a fussy trait that seems at odds with his physical appearance. The general's rugged stature also conceals his two ongoing sources of pain: his wife Martha's inability to bear a child, and the terrible anguish that comes from his deteriorating teeth. Right now, the situation with Martha cannot be helped. Their 18th wedding anniversary is just days away, but the general long ago sent her back to Mount Vernon to be away from the fighting. Despite the physical distance, theirs is a devoted and affectionate partnership. And as a man of honor and deep integrity, Washington realizes that straying from the marital bed can only undermine his moral stature as a leader of men. "I retain an unalterable affection for you, which neither time nor distance can change," he wrote to Martha earlier in the war, signing the letter, "Your entire George Washington." Footnote: Martha will save her husband's letters for the rest of her life, though in an effort to keep their love life private, she will one day burn all but two of them. End footnote. Washington's other cause of personal pain is not so easily hidden. He has almost no teeth. The general blames a childhood habit of cracking walnuts with his molars for the dentures he now wears. The false teeth are made of hippopotamus ivory held in his mouth by strands of gold wire affixed to his few remaining real teeth. Thus, Washington smiles little and lives with the constant pain of inflamed gums from the ill-fitting dentures. He grumbles about the way the fake teeth make his lips puff outward, and he is obsessed with all manner of dental gadgetry, spending a regular portion of his income on teeth scrapers, tooth powder, dental files, and medication to ease the pain. His stoic countenance has added to the heroic stature in which his soldiers view him. In his refusal to smile or unduly celebrate, they see a brave and humble leader. There is no such adulation of Lieutenant General Charles Cornwallis. 6 years younger than Washington, Cornwallis is an outstanding officer, having shown his prowess at the Battle of New York and the British victory at Fort Washington. Yet, Cornwallis also has the unfortunate task of taking orders from General William Howe. The wealthy and educated Cornwallis, who has spent his entire adult life fighting Britain's wars around the world, considers Howe a timid playboy. Cornwallis favors a strategy of rapid assaults designed to surprise and ultimately crush an opponent. He chafes at Howe's preference for more patient, methodical plans of attack. Yet, as Howe's subordinate, the chubby Cornwallis has no choice but to carry out his commands. The rank and file will follow him into battle just as they would any other British general, for that is their duty. Cornwallis is not the sort to ride into the thick of the fray aboard a white charger, risking his life in the manner of George Washington. Instead, the British general stays to the rear of the action, issuing commands as information comes in from his frontline officers. Like Washington, Cornwallis is happily married. He and his wife have a son and daughter, now safely ensconced at their family estate in Kent. There was a time when Cornwallis was uncomfortable fighting the American rebels, for he voted in favor of their cause while serving in the House of Lords. But while he admires and considers George Washington an old fox for his ability to use deception, the British commander is also keen to crush the rebels and go home. With the sun quickly sinking, the British charge the bridge over Assunpink Creek, three times trying to penetrate Washington's lines and three times being pushed back by colonial cannon. "We let them come on some ways," American Sergeant Joseph White will remember. "Then, by a signal given, we all fired together." The last volley is deadly canister shot, clusters of iron spheres twice the size of musket balls flying through the air at lethal speed, making a terrible squeaking noise, designed to wound large numbers of opponents with each single cannon blast. The bridge looked red as blood, with their killed and wounded and their red coats, Sergeant White will recall of the carnage. Indeed, British losses are significant, with dozens of dead and wounded. As the sun finally sets and the sky over New Jersey countryside turns pitch black, the British leadership debates its next move. Attacking in the dark brings a host of tactical problems, but they are aware of Washington's tendency to use the dead of night to his advantage. "If Washington is the general I take him to be," warns General Cornwallis's quartermaster, Sir William Erskine, "his army will not be there by morning." But another general, James Grant, disagrees, arguing that Washington's only avenue of escape is by crossing the Delaware yet again. He reminds Cornwallis that Washington has no boats nearby to make that flight possible. Cornwallis knows he has the manpower to encircle Washington's entire army right now and perhaps end the war. He is equally aware, however, that his soldiers are exhausted. The British regulars' long march from Princeton, carrying their requisite 60-pound load of weaponry and clothing, has taken the edge off his men. A hot meal and a night of sleep seem prudent. Convinced that Washington is trapped, Cornwallis orders a halt to the attack. He confidently tells the Council of War, "We'll go over and bag him in the morning." The British will attack at first light with a frontal assault while simultaneously crossing the Assunpink on the right side of the rebel lines in a pincer movement. The battle will be bloody. Of that, Cornwallis is sure. An entrenched foe is not defeated without great loss of life. The American artillery commanders have improved enormously since the war began and will surely order their men to fire point-blank rounds into the advancing redcoat columns as they did earlier today. Setting up camp on the same hill where Washington observed the Battle of Trenton 1 week earlier, Cornwallis and the British build their campfires and stare across to the other side of the city, where it is clear from the many fires blazing that the Americans are doing the same. They can hear the sound of pickaxes and shovels working through the night as Washington's men continue digging fortifications for tomorrow's battle. Tonight, Lieutenant General Charles Cornwallis sleeps well, believing that victory is all but assured. Come morning, Cornwallis arises and is stunned. Washington and his army are gone. In fact, well before noon, after a silent night-long march down a seldom-used back road unknown to the British, General George Washington attacked and destroyed the small redcoat force occupying Princeton and captured the town. Among the heroes is a young artillery captain named Alexander Hamilton, whom Washington soon plans to promote. Once Princeton is secure, the Continental Army is immediately on the move, heading north toward Morristown, 37 miles away, a position separated from the British garrison in New York by a protective ridgeline called the Short Hills. Cornwallis realizes that Washington has outsmarted him. He is now racing to New Brunswick, New Jersey, to protect British supplies and money there. In this way, the war of rebellion continues, and Cornwallis's dreams of returning to England are dashed. The Battle for Princeton was brief but intense. The American forces were led by General Hugh Mercer. The 50-year-old Scot is a physician and soldier who fought on the losing side during the Jacobite Rising in Scotland of 1745 to 46, then smuggled himself into America to escape persecution from the British. He settled down in Pennsylvania and began a private medical practice, only to take up arms alongside George Washington in the French and Indian War. Mercer is known for his bravery and his stubborn refusal to die, as is evidenced by his 100-mile solo march through thick forest to safety after being wounded in battle against Shawnee warriors in 1756. It is sunrise on January 3, 1777, as General Mercer leads the Continental Army's advance column toward Princeton. A sudden freeze iced the roads after midnight, allowing the Americans to slip away from Trenton and march on Princeton without the thick mud that exhausted the redcoats less than 24 hours earlier. The wheels of the cannon are wrapped in cloth to dampen the sound. Once again, as in Brooklyn, the order has been spread that the men must not speak or even cough so as to maintain silence during the escape. Some Americans actually fall asleep on their feet during the 10-mile journey through the darkness, yet somehow the colonials manage to shuffle forward in unison. The rags covering the freezing feet of the shoeless are drenched in blood. It is the job of General Mercer and his 350 men from Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania to destroy the bridge at the Post Road, 2 miles outside Princeton. This will block Cornwallis's force from a hasty return once it becomes aware of Washington's ruse. Suddenly, Mercer and his men come upon a large body of British troops marching south to reinforce the Trenton attack. Neither side expects to see the other at this early hour, so the British commander, Colonel John Mawhood, at first mistakes Mercer's army for Hessian reinforcements. "They could not possibly suppose it was our army," Bostonian soldier Henry Knox will later remember. "I believe they were as much astonished as if an army had dropped perpendicularly upon them." The surprise encounter brings forth confusion and violent death. When, after an early volley, the Americans are slow to reload their muskets, the British sprint into their lines with bayonets drawn. Mercer's gray horse buckles as it is shot by a musket ball. The courageous general finds himself alone and surrounded by a band of British soldiers. He is wearing an overcoat that covers his uniform and rank insignia. Aware that George Washington wears just such a cloak on the field of battle, the jubilant British believe they have actually captured the American commander-in-chief. "Surrender, you damn rebel," the redcoats command. Mercer will not. 50 yards away, he can see what happens to rebels who yield. One lieutenant with a broken leg was dragged from beneath the wagon where he was hiding, bludgeoned with a gun butt to the point of near unconsciousness, and then repeatedly bayoneted. Another captured lieutenant, Bartholomew Yates, was stabbed 13 times and died. Mercer draws his saber and attacks. The regulars swarm the Scottish immigrant, taunting him as they wait for the moment to pounce. It would be simple merely to shoot him, but they do not wish General Washington to enjoy such a hasty demise. Finally, a swinging gun butt catches Mercer in the head. He collapses. More blows rain down on his skull, leaving the general unconscious. Then the British bayonet him. But still, Mercer lives. Soon afterward, the real George Washington gallops into battle to rally Mercer's men, ultimately turning the tide of the battle in favor of the colonials. He appears out of nowhere, his presence encouraging the Americans to press the attack at a time when many are beginning to flee in terror. Colonel Mawhood's 2 infantry regiments and his column of light cavalry stand between the Americans and Princeton. Turning back toward Trenton is not an option. Washington gallops through his army, pushing them back to the fight. "Parade with us, my dear fellows," the American general cries from astride his horse, his voice calm and cool. He fearlessly puts himself in range of British musket fire, but behaves as if he were in no danger at all. "There is but a handful of the enemy, and we will have them directly," he shouts. The rebels respond. They now fall upon the enemy with utter fury. British dead and wounded soon litter the local orchard. Colonel Mawhood and the rest of his terrified men sprint for their lives. Washington gives chase on horseback, but then lets them go, ordering his army once again to turn toward Princeton and victory. It was a glorious day. I happened to be in the first and hottest of the fire. Pennsylvania Junior Officer Joseph Reed will write home to his wife about the sight of Washington seizing command of the battle. I would wish to say a few words of the actions respecting that truly great man, General Washington, but it is not in the power of language to convey any just idea of him. His greatness is far beyond description. I shall never forget what I felt at Princeton on his account, when I saw him brave all the dangers of the field and his important life hanging as it were by a single hair with 1,000 deaths flying around him. Believe me, I thought not of myself. He is surely America's better genius. Meanwhile, General Hugh Mercer is carried from the field and taken to a farmhouse that has been converted into a field hospital, where his severe wounds are tended to by Dr. Benjamin Rush, coincidentally a signatory to the Declaration of Independence. Mercer clings to life, his crumpled skull and stab wounds a vivid reminder of the fate that awaits George Washington should he ever fall into British hands. 9 days after the battle, General Mercer breathes his last. Footnote. Among General Mercer's descendants are legendary composer Johnny Mercer and World War II General George S. Patton. End footnote. Washington has already said goodbye to his dear belligerent friend and is finally settling into winter quarters in Morristown, there to regroup and drill his army for the summer campaign. The tide of the war has turned, and Washington's victories are celebrated throughout the colonies. In London, some British are questioning the need to wage war in the colonies. In Paris, where Benjamin Franklin has now labored for a month to entice the French into helping the rebel cause, the news of Trenton, Princeton, and Morristown is cause for jubilation. The French have long been awaiting for a sign that the Americans can actually win this war. Finally, Washington has provided one.